All right, welcome back to Computer Science E75. This is lecture 2, where we continue our discussion of PHP. There will be a section after class across the hall, like last time, if you're able to stick around. Alex will be your section leader here and back. And the goal of those classes, again, is to review some of the material from lecture, whether this week or last, to talk a bit about the current projects as applicable, and then also to look at more examples that are on point related to the week. With that said, any questions about what's in progress, which is presumably for you Project Zero? Any questions? Yeah?
I'll just note that I didn't realize that we had to fill out the form before we got the shell.
Ah, okay.
So I don't know if anyone else is laboring. I was kind of waiting for the shell mail to come.
Oh, just to happen.
Yeah,
no, you have to tell us who you are in terms of your domain and such. So, yeah, so it is two parts. So do review the spec if you haven't already. Step one is essentially buy the domain name. Step two is to figure out how to configure a CNAME record that maps, for instance, projects.foo.com to cloud.cs75.net. And once that's in place and you inform us of the actual CNAME that you've created, can we then set up this thing called a virtual host on the cloud servers so that when requests start coming in for Project Zero, Project One and beyond, we will know, oh, this is projects.foo.com. Let me map this to Mr. Foo's account and his corresponding public HTML directory or the like. But we've been turning them around. We had a little hiccup over the weekend as we were still getting things going, if you experience some delay. But I think right now we've responded to all of the forms that have been submitted and provided the usernames and passwords. If not, just ping us. Yeah?
Just a quick question. In the write-up for the for this particular project,
mm-hmm.
we've mentioned something about this being the basis for everything else that comes after.
Mm-hmm.
Does that imply that we should be doing a basic site that might become our larger site later?
Ah, good question. So for the microphone here, the project spec mentions that this setup will be the foundation for projects to come. That's really in terms of the structure, not in terms of the aesthetics. In fact, for each project, the content of the project, the structure of the project will vary. And while you're welcome to kind of brand it in a consistent way, I think you'll find that you won't necessarily be able to use precisely the same template. So just realize directory structure is here to stay. Yeah.
Hmm?
Sure.
But I have a sketchy on the mechanics of it. Is it a text file, or is it simply a notification on where you bought the domain?
Good question. And so the question for the mic again is, what is exactly a CNAME? How does it work? And where, in what way is it configured? So short answer is it depends. In principle, the CNAME record, which recall is a DNS record, that's really just a synonym that maps one fully qualified domain name, like projects.foo.com, to another, like cloud.cs75.net. This is generally done with your web host, wherever you are actually hosting your website. But this isn't always the case, and in fact, this is not the case in this scenario. What you can generally do with most internet registrars is you can park your domain on their own servers. What this generally means is that when you park your domain or buy it and don't actually do anything with it yet, if someone visits foo.com, what they see is a big page of advertisements for GoDaddy or whoever you bought it from. But it's good to park your domain at your registrar because this means that they will be configured by default to use GoDaddy's name servers, ns1.godaddy.com, ns2.whatever, whatever they happen to be, which means you can create DNS records in your registrar site, for instance, GoDaddy, that then maps internet users to any other server. So pretty much, for instance, for my domains, even though I host various domains and projects I maintain, some on Harvard servers, some on my own, some on a virtual private server, I pretty much have gotten into the habit of using GoDaddy for all of my DNS so that it's all in one place. They have good uptime and they have lots of redundancy, and this way I don't have to like maintain multiple different DNS setups. I just go to the one place. So that's exactly what we're having you all do here. So if you bought your domain from GoDaddy or someone else, you will buy the domain, and then you're going to have to figure out with them how you can create this CNAME record. We kind of piggybacked off of Google Apps, which has a lot of nice documentation for doing this for Google Apps. And because what we're doing is pretty much the same as setting up a hosted domain for Google Apps, this is why the spec just points you to their documentation. But it's going to vary. Most likely, you're going to go to a web interface on your registrar site. You're going to say, create a CNAME called projects that maps to cloud.cs75.net. You're going to click OK, and then you're going to be informed within 24 to 72 hours what you just did will take effect. Now, mechanically, what does that mean? That means henceforth, when you or a friend or family member pull up a browser, go to http://projects.foo.com, your computer, Mac or PC, is going to first translate that fully qualified domain name to an IP address. How does it do that? Well, if you're at home, your computer is going to be pre-configured to talk to probably your home router, your little Airport Express, your Linksys device, or whatever, which tends to have a DNS server or a caching DNS server built in. If you have never visited projects.foo.com, obviously this person's Airport Extreme isn't going to know what you're talking about. So to whom does the request then get forwarded, most likely, if you're at home and you're trying to visit projects.foo.com? Yeah, so to the ISP. You're going to go to like the Verizon's FiOS DNS servers or Comcast cable modem DNS servers, whoever the nearest provider is to which you're directly connected. They, in turn, have probably never heard of projects.foo.com before because you just bought this domain and set up this CNAME record. So there's going to be some recursion until eventually someone might very well ask the so-called root servers, hey, this is foo.com, so the .com root DNS server surely must know where in the world the DNS servers for this thing are. And eventually that request reaches GoDaddy. GoDaddy says, oh, I don't know the IP address, but I know that projects.foo.com is the same as cloud.cs75.net. So the response comes back that then I have to recursively go figure out cloud.cs75.net's IP. So correct. So the CNAME, the canonical name, will necessarily map projects.yourdomain.com to cloud.cs75.net. And you have to do it for the subdomain because the root of your domain, foo.com itself has to be an A record, which is a direct map to an IP address, which we looked at last week. Plus, this way, too, you can come up with a fake domain name, use it just for the course, and you don't have to disrupt anything else you have going on in your domain. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry if this is...
No. All new.
No, it's projects.mydomainname.com, and the CNAME I'm creating to that would be cloud.cs75.net.
Correct, yeah. Yep. And again, it's going to how you do this differs, but Google, thankfully, as you see in the URL in the project PDF, has a bunch of directions for different popular registrars. Generally you'll specify just the host name, the leftmost portion of the name. You don't have to write out the whole thing. But again, this is where it varies by registrar. Yep.
What's the document root for the virtual host?
What's the document? What is it specifically, or was it in principle?
When I set up my projects.foo.com, what's the document root? Is it project zero?
Good question. So there's actually two, just so that we have a default, but then one that follows the pattern for the other projects. So what you'll see in the email that you get sent by the CS75 bot is that we are creating accounts for you on the so-called cloud. All of your home directories, your personal storage space, live in the root of the server in a directory called home by convention in Linux and Unix worlds. And then, for instance, mine is in /malin. And what we did, just to simplify things early on in the term, we took the liberty of pre-creating a whole bunch of subdirectories for people in their home directories. So what you'll see is we pre-created for you, per this email, a projects directory in your home directory. And then we have a bunch of subdirectories in here, 0, 1, 2, 3, and final. And we'll talk a bit more about this today and moving forward. And then in there, can you actually put document roots, which we've decided will follow the convention /HTML, which is pretty consistent with a lot of standard web server setups. So when you go henceforth to projects.foo.com, we have configured the cloud to automatically point that user at this path at the very top. So for instance, your index.html or index.htm, whatever you call your default file by convention, is going to end up in this directory. But as we say, kind of as a footnote in this email, we also have enabled things on the cloud so that you can go to projects.foo.com/0 and you will find yourself in the same place. And that was just because it felt a little stupid to have you get this new domain name or new subdomain, and yet to see anything of interest, you have to go to /0. So we figured we'd put it in the root as well.
The Apache test page.
That should not be the case. If that's the case, then it sounds like we haven't configured your particular vhost. Did you get an email response from us?
Yeah, I was able to SSH in.
Interesting. So drop us a note. It sounds like something might have failed when we created your structure, because you should not be seeing the test Apache page. It sounds like maybe we have a typo or something like that in the vhost setup.
But then when I
uploaded it in index.html, Oh, okay, so that's consistent actually with this version of Apache. Okay, so let me retract what I just said. If you actually don't have a file in /HTML, it looks like Apache presumptuously shows you its little default advertisement.
Okay, I did have one.
Okay, so if you upload index.html with the right permissions, which is something we'll discuss not so much in, we can certainly discuss it in class, but in sections and such, we'll focus on some of the lower level mechanics, it should make that page automatically disappear. Yeah?
In terms of write-ups for the project, mm-hmm. is there anything other than the presence or absence of the web page on the server that determines the project?
Nope. In this case, we will simply take a look at the prescribed location to make sure that what is there is in fact consistent with the specifications. Moving forward, there might be a more deliberate process, but the spec itself will always say what to do. And if it says nothing, you need do nothing other than finish by that point. Other questions? No? Okay. Oh, so just as this seat might strike some of you, at least those with who've played around with Apache before, as maybe unnecessarily complex. And the reason for this is threefold. And you'll perhaps realize this more over time as we deploy the actual projects. So one, we wanted to make sure we isolate each of the projects to its own subdirectory so that you don't have to worry about interfering with other code that you wrote and so forth. And it just keeps things nice and clean. But we've also followed the convention of having in your zero directory, in your one directory, and so forth, also one step further, which might feel a little excessive to put HTML here. But the motivation for this is actually compelling. As you'll see, not only have we pre-created an HTML directory, we'll also encourage you to only put, for the course and in general, things in your HTML directory that should actually be publicly accessible. So if there's a foo.php file that is meant to be accessed by people on the internet, then it belongs there. But if you're writing instead a helper file that contains just some useful functions, if you're writing a file with constants.php that's meant just to contain constants and database usernames and passwords, you could absolutely just put it in the HTML directory, and then we'll see over time you can include or require that, much like you can import in Java or Sharp include in C and C++. But the danger is that if someone guesses that you probably have a file called config.php, and so they go to projects.foo.com/0/config.php, depending on whether or not you've made some mistakes, they might very well see all of your usernames and passwords. Now, by default, this should not happen. If the web server is properly configured, should not happen. But absolutely do things go wrong. For instance, you might accidentally disable PHP if you're the sysadmin, if briefly, the result of which is anytime someone visits a page, they see the raw PHP source, and there goes the security of your code and your constants. So as a matter of best practice, what folks will often do is they'll put anything that has to be publicly accessible in HTML or in htdoc. Is another convention, or in public_HTML, all these different conventions. But if you want to keep things safe from prying eyes, you might also have, for instance, a lib directory, a library where you put any helper functions you might write. You might put an Etsy directory, which might contain all of your configuration details. And then you just access via relative paths, dot, dot, and so forth, any files that you need to include. But this directory is not directly accessible on the internet. This one is not directly accessible on the internet. Thanks to that document root directive from last week, the web community is isolated to things that are only in this directory. So it's a matter of best practice. The names might differ. On a normal system, you're probably not going to have a project subdirectory. It might instead be called domains or just public HTML. But as a matter of best practice, just isolating each of your projects for the course and beyond into different subdirectories based on role is generally a good thing. Avoids getting yourself into trouble accidentally. So and we'll spell this out in project one when we actually specify how to lay things out and such. Any questions? Okay, so we talked last week about actually using PHP. So PHP is an interesting thing because it's clearly very intertwined with HTML. We've had simple examples last week where we drop in and out of PHP mode, and by that I mean we had open bracket question mark, then some code, then we closed it with question mark close bracket. And so this allowed us to commingle HTML and PHP, and often this is pretty compelling. It allows you to have some static content, but then intersperse some dynamic content like your user's user's name or the contents of their shopping cart or whatever the application is that you might be trying to implement. As projects get bigger, you'll find maybe especially around the time for your final project that this starts to get messy potentially quickly if you're mixing so-called business logic with presentation details and so forth. So realize out there, and we'll touch briefly upon these later in the semester, that there's a lot of templating systems that people have created for PHP whereby you can put all of your HTML in one page and all of your like placeholder variables in one file, but then all of your actual code and logic lives elsewhere. But initially, to keep things simple, we'll generally commingle the two because the two, HTML and PHP, really are married by design of the PHP language. So in terms of dynamism, it's useful to be able to output data dynamically, right? Even on the course's own homepage, if you visited the lectures page or the resources page or the software page, all of these things follow a fairly simple formula. There's like bold-faced words with descriptive text, and then there's another, and then another, and another. We could absolutely maintain these pages just by editing some HTML, but over time, we generally update the aesthetics of the website or change things around. Certainly, after a few recommended pieces of software, even I find myself cringing that I'm just copying and pasting the same HTML code again and again. So in fact, underneath the hood, a lot of the course's website is driven by configuration files, not by static HTML. In fact, there are no .html files, and even what .php files are there, even though you generally don't see it in the URL because we've hidden them, they are generally outputting pages dynamically based on configuration files. Now, what configs? Well, we actually chose XML. So XML is extensible markup language. It is sort of all the rage, and yet what's compelling about it is just its simplicity. Those familiar already with HTML can think of XML as like a custom version of HTML, where you get to make up the tags, you get to make up the attributes. And what's nice is that there are so many free tools and software that you can incorporate into your own code that reads and writes XML files. So you might have played around since last week or in the past at Apache's configuration file, and they kind of have some XML syntax. Recall we saw the open bracket, virtual host, close bracket, and such. But then they just have lines of text. The php.ini file, which is PHP's own config file, follows the convention of it's just text, top to bottom, and every line is a variable, equals value, semicolon. And then again and again, actually, is that true? No semicolon, but the semicolon is the comment character, if you want to comment something. For some reason, they chose that as opposed to any number of other standards. So in short, you can come up with dozens of examples of popular software projects that have their own custom or proprietary configuration file formats, and they might be pretty straightforward to read, but they had to write their own custom parser, their own custom program to actually read this configuration file in and do something with the data and then maybe potentially change it. What's compelling about XML, frankly, is that you don't have to reinvent this stupid wheel. You don't have to implement a program whose purpose in life is to read your own program's configuration files and then hand you the data that's being stored in those config files. You can instead call a function like parseXML or simpleXML loads file, as we'll see something called soon, that just does all of this for you. And what you get handed back, essentially, is a big tree or a big hash table, a map of sorts that you can then traverse in a standard way to get at things you care about. So let's make this a little more real. I'm going to go ahead and log into the course's website via SSH. And I'm going to go into, the convention we followed is pretty arbitrary. I'm going to go into our Etsy XML file directory, and I'm going to pull up a file called lectures.xml. It looks a little ugly on the screen because I've made the font pretty big, but this is just kind of an arbitrary but simple XML format that I came up with because I just wanted a clean way of representing the various resources on the course's website. And then I went ahead and wrote a little PHP file that reads in this XML file, top to bottom, left to right, traverses over all of the indented elements and just spits out the appropriate HTML. So anytime, in fact, in a couple of hours when we post the slides from tonight and any source code examples, I change like two, maybe three lines of code, save the file, done. Website updates itself. Now, this is not all that novel an idea, right? You could just configure things in a database. You could have a web-based configuration. But frankly, a lot of projects can be very reasonably solved by just something quick and dirty, an XML file where you tweak it, you edit it, and it drives the rest of your application, and I didn't have to write any of the code that interprets this file structure. So long as I adhere to the idea of open tags and closed tags and attributes with quotes around them, I can outsource that whole part of the project, which is really quite compelling. And we'll see how to use this in just a moment. Now, as for the particulars of this format, doesn't really matter, because this is completely homegrown. You could call these things anything you want, but there's a few key details that I'll at least point out. So at the top of any XML document, there is what's called a root element. This is most any name you want to give it, though there are some constraints. Can't start with a number, can't start with weird characters. So in general, you know, with uppercase or lowercase alphabetical letters, you're pretty safe, though there's some others that you can actually use. And if I scroll down to the very bottom of this file, I will see down here the close tag, open bracket, slash, lectures, just like you would an HTML tag or most any other tags with open and close tags, elements with open and close tags. So now notice the indentation. This too is irrelevant for the computer, but it's useful for the humans. Notice I seem to have a lecture element as the first child of lectures, so to speak, then a second lecture element as the second child, and then probably after tonight there'll be a third child for lecture two, zero index. Now inside there we have a similar the indented structure. Notice that we gave the zeroth lecture a title of HTTP. We specified for the dates element the particular date of that lecture. And then this gets a little more interesting. I wanted to genericize the notion of a resource for lecture, because sometimes it's a link, sometimes it's a PDF, sometimes it's a video. And so I decided arbitrarily we're going to have a parent element called resources, closed here and opened up there. And this is going to contain zero or more resource elements. Now, I could have called this handout element or video element. But here, too, what I was trying to do was abstract away these ideas. So I called them all the same thing, resource, so that I can iterate over this file pretty generically and just change the name that I'm spitting out based on some attributes. So what do I do? Well, it looks like for that first lecture, recall that we had some slides on the screen, which I posted as lecture0.pdf. I gave it a label of quote unquote PDF, but that's completely arbitrary. Another resource was the syllabus, which is similarly linked there with a relative link on the course's website. And then we have the video in a couple of formats. We have a flash format here, and then also a streaming MP4 format. And this is where it gets a little interesting, too. I decided, just because I like these aesthetics, that if there were multiple formats available for some resource, maybe the PDF version, maybe the zip version for source code, or in the case of the videos, maybe flash, maybe MP4, just because I was being a little design-oriented or anal, I wanted every resource to be listed line by line. But if there's multiple formats for a resource, I wanted to start listing it laterally after a colon and some pipes, right? So if you haven't looked too recently, the end result of all this fanciness is a website that looks like this. So I have the lecture number and title, the date of the lecture, and then here is an example of the multi-formats, video colon, then this thing, or this thing. So I just needed some way of embodying that, and so I arbitrarily decided, but I think pretty reasonably, that we would just have multiple formats as children of a resource. So my logic in my PHP code just has to detect this. If the number of children is greater than one, I need to start chaining them with vertical bars laterally in terms of HTML. As for the specifics of the rest of the document, it pretty much follows this pattern. So yes, I'm copying and pasting each week, but I'm only copying and pasting my raw data. And I literally have separated out my data from anything resembling aesthetic markup or logic. So this alone is a pretty compelling feature. Now, who cares? Why even? Who cares, frankly, how the course's website is implemented? Well, there's a lot of projects, especially when using PHP or Perl or Python or Ruby or whatever your favorite language is, that you need to store some amount of data. And you want to render that data dynamically. You might want that data to change over time, whether by human input at a keyboard or maybe the program itself is morphing these XML files and updating them. But you have, like, 10 users, and they hit the page maybe a few times a day, maybe a few times per second. You don't really need a full-fledged database solution. You certainly don't need an Oracle license. Frankly, you don't want to waste time even figuring out how to install MySQL, which, though free, still involves some bit of savvy and time to get set up. It's just an unnecessarily heavy-handed solution. Or on your server, you just don't have the ability to install these services, like MySQL or some other database server. All you need is the ability to read and write data. Now, in yesteryear, you might use any number of approaches. You might take the Apache and the PHP approach of just invent your own configuration file, right? Decide on a format, make sure the humans can write it, make sure the program can read it. But why? When you can just use, as we'll see, some off-the-shelf tools and functions to read all of this for you and even write it. Moreover, What's another popular text file for a flat file database, as one might say? So CSV, so comma separated variables, is pretty compelling in that it's so easy to output. You just output data separated by commas. There is some trickery in case the data itself has commas, in which case quotes are generally your solution. The world also likes TSVs, tab separated values, PSVs, pipe separated values, whatever you're using to separate your values. These are pretty simple, but XML at least offers something that's even better, arguably, than those formats. What does XML offer that CSV, TSV, PSV do not, apparently? Yeah?
Validation.
Okay, so one, validation. So this is a good one, and I've not even mentioned that here, but as part of the definition of XML, you can have what's called a DTD, document type definition, or XML schema, which essentially is a grammar or specification for what your own custom XML format should look like in order to be considered valid. And one of the things you get for free with a lot of these XML tools, which we'll look at in the context of PHP, is the ability to call a function or pass in true for some parameter and say, you know what, don't only read this file from disk and hand me the tree structure in memory, the data structure I want back. Also check that this thing actually is structured in the way I said in my specification it should be. And this can help ward off errors on your part. If two companies, say Amazon.com and one of their third-party booksellers or whoever they partner with are exchanging purchase orders using XML, you can make sure at the validation stage that you will just outright reject the PO if it is missing certain fields, fields that you specified in your DTD or your schema. So in short, XML, you get this feature for free, even though I'm not using it here, mostly because if I can't trust myself, then there's some other issues going on. But it just didn't seem worth, for instance, imposing validation on myself. I'll know when I reload the page if I broke something. Other things that XML seems to offer that CSV does not? Yeah, so this is where it gets really compelling, frankly. One of the frustrations, arguably, with CSV or anything that's kind of this line-by-line, row-by-row format is there's no notion of hierarchy. There's no notion of children elements or nesting and the like. And maybe that's okay, but as soon as you get to the point of having data that just conceptually is structural, you can't really represent that in a flat file, or at least you can't very elegantly. If you flatten it out, you simply have to have lots and lots of columns now with names, for instance, in the top row that signify their role. So it's doable, but it's just not necessarily very clean. Now, ironically, when we get to MySQL in just a week or two, we're going to have to, unfortunately, backpedal from this notion of hierarchy because MySQL, as a relational database system, is all about rows and columns. But at least in that world, we'll see we have things called primary keys and foreign keys. We'll have the ability to take one set of rows and columns and another, join them together somehow. And these are just built into SQL in MySQL, but not, for instance, into just what's a text file, a CSV. So in short, this is the structure of XML. For the most part, it's pretty self-explanatory to anyone familiar with HTML. It is HTML, but make your own tags and attributes with some constraints. But for the most part, anything reasonable syntactically tends to work just fine. And we offer it now because you'll see in one of the course's first projects, it just doesn't warrant it to actually use a full-fledged database. That would be too heavy-handed a solution. But it is a prime opportunity to come up with a schema, sort of a mental model for your XML, and then implement your database using really just a text editor, which frankly is a very reasonable starting point, as we'll see. And thankfully, too, as we'll also see, there exists capabilities in XML for searching, too. So right now, it might not be obvious how I can find, for instance, give me all of the URLs in MP4 format. I could iterate over this file looking and looking, but just like SQL, which is a query language for relational databases, so does XML have something called XPath, XML path language, with which, much like a file system, we'll be able to do things like get me all of the lecture elements that have, let's say, get me all of the lectures that, for instance, were released in, let's see, resources. Making a mess of the screen here, that have resources, and I'm just going to say dot, dot, dot for now, you can use what are called predicates, as we'll see with these square bracket notations. So using this very simple file system-like syntax, C colon backslash and the like, you can pluck out data you actually care about from XML. So this, too, is a pretty powerful thing. And for reasonably sized XML documents, a few megabytes, works pretty impressively. Probably you don't want to store tens and tens of megabytes or hundreds or gigabytes in XML format because you're just going to waste time reading and writing from disk. But certainly for reasonable data sets, it's quite compelling. So any questions on some of the just constructs underlying XML? And we'll return to some of the usage. Yeah?
What's the scale of the amount of data you have to have before it really starts to pay off to have it in a database? Like, is there a certain, you know, is it like 10 megabytes or like 50 megabytes, or does it depend on the complexity of your data?
So that's a really good question. At what point do you really want to segue from, say, an XML file or even a CSV file to something like a relational database? I think it depends on the context. So if it's the human who's editing these files, I think if you're pushing, frankly, 1,000 or more lines of XML or CSV that you yourself are configuring for whatever reason, you might be pushing it at that point. With that said, I mean, arguably even Apache and PHP, some of these big systems themselves might have huge configuration files. Frankly, I don't have a hard, fast rule. I would say if the file is a megabyte or more, you're probably at the point where this thing's just becoming unwieldy to maintain by hand anyway, at which point maybe a database setup is compelling. But the bigger determinant, I think, for real systems would be performance. The downside of XML is that, for instance, the course's website. Right now, because we've implemented it in a fairly quick and dirty way, because it gets the job done, every time you visit the lectures page, that XML file gets parsed, which means it's read from the disk. It's read from top to bottom, left to right. All of these elements are handed to us in RAM as some kind of hierarchical data structure that we can then navigate, much like you would in a data structures class, any kind of data structure in memory. We output the page, and then we throw all of that hard work away. The next time someone visits the lecture page, all of that happens again, and again, and again. Now, I say we did this quick and dirty, because as we'll discuss toward the end of the course on scalability, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in PHP and in the web world, where you can just cache this output pretty easily. Frankly, we could write a few lines of code that cache these outputs, and so you would only be getting the cached HTML every time. But the reality is, unless you're obsessively waiting for the next lecture to come up, odds are we're not only getting a few hits per minute, per second on this site, so we just didn't bother. But there too, if your traffic patterns are such that you're talking about hundreds of hits per second, certainly thousands of hits per second, unnecessarily reading the same XML files again and again, it's probably starting to get stupid, at which point you want something like a database engine, which runs when the server boots up, it stays resident in memory, and therefore, in theory, can respond to queries much more quickly. And that's what we'll get when we introduce MySQL. Yeah?
So you've got this order in the way that you want the HTML to appear.
Mm-hmm.
Do the XML tools allow you to sort on fields before you display?
Yes. Yes and no. You have limited sorting capabilities with at least XPath, this path-like language. You have more capabilities with another language, which we won't look at in the course, called XQuery, which has been around for a while. It's getting traction in certain systems, but hasn't quite had the penetration as I think a lot of people would have hoped. So short answer, yes. But in general, certainly when you have access to a scripting language, it's often easier and more versatile to just do that in code. Get back the raw data and then massage it any way you want. Yeah. That's a good question. So there is for PHP. I don't know if, yeah, so PHP, absolutely. I don't know if there's anything Apache specific. This too is a language we won't look at in this particular course, but XSLT, Extensible Style Sheet Transformations. This is a language. It's a functional programming language that is actually written in XML. So you write open bracket, close brackets, and all of this, but each of the tags that you write is essentially a function that you might invoke or something along those lines, a loop that you call. What's nice about XSLT is that even though the syntax isn't necessarily the most fun to code in and it's pretty verbose like most of XML is, it's the T stands for transformations, which means you can write an XSLT document, apply it to an XML document, and the purpose in life of XSLT is generally to transform that XML document into another XML document, or maybe a text file, or maybe a PDF. HTML, or XHTML at least, is a subset of XML, or is an instance of XML, so it's actually very apropos in the web world to store your data in XML format, apply XSLT transformations to it, and get back, for instance, the HTML that you want. Using PHP itself is kind of an alternative to that. You can either use XSLT or use PHP. XSLT is really nice in the context of templating systems, which again we'll revisit. So in short, if that was a lot sort of too soon, that's fine. That's not a particular language, but I can plug my own hibernated course. If you go to cs259.tv, we actually used to offer a course at Extension on XML with Java, where pretty much the whole focus of the course was XML stuff in the context of the Java programming language. So we spent a good amount of time on XSLT and XPath and others in that class, all of whose videos and such are still on the web. And frankly, not all that much has changed in that world. So even though the course has been sleeping for a couple of years, it's pretty much still accurate. Yeah.
Is it possible or advisable to have sort of a combination of XML and PHP? I'm thinking if you have a company website, you have old products with lots and lots of pages of reviews, comments, manuals, and then you just have smaller set of products, newer ones that maybe will be discarded.
Okay.
For the older ones, you use PHP because you've got all that data.
Okay.
But for the smaller one, just starting out, you use XML until you thought you were ready to go over to PHP.
It's a good question. So let me try to tease it. Let me try to push back on one detail. I wouldn't really say that PHP is an alternative to XML or vice versa, because PHP, as we'll see even more today, is truly a programming language, a procedural programming language with which you can implement logical constructs like loops and function calls and all of this. XML is just a dumb markup language that you can use to semantically tag your data to say, this is a lecture, this is a PDF, and so forth, but there's no logic related to it. So I would say that they're very much different. So I don't think there's really a question of should you use one or the other, at least for that particular scenario, if that's fair. Other questions? Okay, so we'll come back to XML. This is really just a teaser of one approach we can take for actually storing our data. But let's go ahead now and try to start doing some more interesting things with PHP itself. By along the way, we'll introduce some additional syntax to PHP or the like. But again, as promised in the first week, we'll generally assume that most everyone in the room has prior programming experience. So seeing a loop might be interesting for like 5 seconds. But after that, you realize, okay, I put some dollar signs in this language that I didn't in another. So I'll try to take some things for granted. But at any point, if you have any questions, honestly, raise your hand, interrupt, lest I be forgetting that I've looked at this stuff for a long time and you've looked at it for just those 5 seconds. So authentication. This is a feature that's predominant on the web, certainly. Go to most any website that has the notion of accounts and you have to log in at some point. Certainly for the course's projects will this be useful, because for at least one of them will you have to implement or require that users log in order to actually access some information. So more on that in the time to come. But here's what such a form might look like. Username and password, a login button, and you click submit, and that data's got to get submitted somewhere. So last week, we kind of fake implemented Google by implementing the front end, which just required an HTML file. The back end, we punted completely. We set the value of the action attribute to be Google's own servers, and then we started to actually implement a back end for those form submissions. Well, let's actually do that now. Receive a form submission from ourselves that handles this idea of authentication and see how we can implement this notion of persistence on a website, whereby you log in once and somehow or other, even though Internet Explorer's little icon has stopped spinning or whatever, even though HTTP is stateless, as they say, and there's no more network connectivity, you still seem to be logged in. And when you click the next page a few seconds later, and the next page a few seconds later, and your web browser reconnects to that server, somehow it's remembering that you already logged in. Because surely you're not logging into the site every darn page that you pull up. So how is this all happening? Well, I'm going to go ahead and open a file here, and I'll put all of this code online after so that you can play with it as well for projects and beyond. Let me go into our lectures directory, which we know exists based on our XML file. Lecture 2, 0 indexed. And I have in here, let's say, login.php, login directory. So I've got a few variants. I'm going to go ahead and first open this page, but let me first spoil what it looks like here. So cs75.net, lectures 2, source, login, home.php. So here is just a placeholder page, because I needed some way of showing us, yay or nay, we're actually logged in. And clearly right now, at this point in the story, home.php, I am not logged in. So this could be a complete fabrication. This could just be a static file that just always says you are not logged in. But in fact, that line of text is dynamically outputted based on knowledge of whether or not I have already logged in once before. So let's try this. Let me go ahead and look at version 1 of my login demo. I get a simple little form here at top left. I'm going to go ahead and type in for username jharvard, and then I'm going to provide a password of nonsense, and I'm going to click login. Okay, invalid login. Didn't give much regard for aesthetics for now. Just wanted something to demonstrate this. But there appears to have been some logic going on. And before we look underneath the hood, let's see if we can't infer exactly what's going on. I'm going to go ahead and open Firefox instead, just because of some of the tools it comes with. I'm going to go ahead and clear my cache so that I don't trip over some previous page reloads of this. I'm going to pull it up. I'm there at the same form, and for now I'm going to use my little buddy Firebug down here, and I'll zoom in as needed because the text is small, and let's go ahead and watch what happens. Notice I'm on the net tab right now, which is going to monitor all HTTP traffic. I'm going to type jharvard, crimson, login. All right, looks like this involved, oh, I spoiled the password, didn't I? All right, that one worked. All right, the password I know in advance to be crimson. Last time I just typed in nonsense. It looks like two things happened. I apparently posted to that page. You would have seen my secret password now anyway. I posted to this page a few things. So let's first look at the request headers. So on the bottom, by convention, Firebug shows us the request headers. And what's actually interesting here? Well, one, the host line, little refresh here. Why is the host line included and also necessary on a lot of servers? Why did my browser state the obvious? I know I went to cs75.net. I typed it into the URL. Yeah. Exactly. So certainly on the cloud servers, certainly on a huge number of web servers, hosting companies on the internet, your companies, your domain names live alongside others at the same IP address. So the server has to be able to multiplex among the various websites on that server. And if the browser is not providing it with a hint or a reminder as to what host name actually led to that IP address, it's not going to know what website to spit out. So thankfully, this is a feature of HTTP. User agent, this is just kind of revealing what kind of browser and OS I'm using. There's some other details here. For instance, this thing is a nice flag. It's saying my browser knows how to zip and unzip files, namely text files you might want to send me. This is good for performance because it means the server can respond, if it wants, with a gzipped, a zipped version of the HTML or file, and then my browser apparently knows how to decompress it, so it can save some bytes that way, so that's good. Some of this stuff isn't all that interesting for now, except, oh, this is interesting. Looks like I have a cookie from my own website already, and it looks like I am using, in this server, PHP, at least because I have a cookie called PHP sesh ID. So we'll start looking at this and we'll start leveraging this in the course's projects after project zero. This is a cookie, a key value pair that apparently this web server put on my computer the first time I visited it. We'll see why that's useful in just a moment. Let's scroll up now to the server's response. So the server responded with some fluffy stuff like the date, like the time, X powered by, kind of a fancy sounding HTTP header that unfortunately is not so good for security, arguably. This is informing me apparently that cs75.net is running PHP 5.2.5. All right, so that's kind of nice, right? It helps people like Google Analytics to know who's running what and all of this, but why is this maybe not best practice? Yeah, it may suggest a vulnerability. How? All it's saying is PHP 5.2. Yeah, so that's the catch. If my web server is just happily telling anyone who asks it on the internet what version of a programming, of an interpreter are you running, and my web server is just happily telling everyone that answer, well, what happens when PHP 5.2.5 is discovered to have a super insecure flaw in it that is very easily exploitable by sending the keyword foo in the parameter string? So now I'm telling the world, you know, enter my website and do bad things because I am running this compromised version of the software. So we've left this on for demonstration purposes here, but thankfully, with one configuration change to PHP, can you hide the version number? And in theory, you can scrub even mentions of X powered by altogether if you really want, but this helps their numbers, and that's frankly why a lot of this stuff is included. Even Apache. Apache, by contrast, also generally spits out its version number, but that too you can disable with one line of config change in Apache. So even though this course focuses more on development, coding, as opposed to sysadmining, there's some very low-hanging fruit that if you just, out of curiosity, start poking around some of your favorite websites, odds are you'll find that even some of the most popular sites haven't realized that these things are on or don't know that they should be turning them off.
Is the X and X powered by, does that have anything to do with X11?
No, not in this case. X. So I suspect in this case, and I'm going to infer from convention, generally when you have these extended properties, they begin with the letter X. You see this in a lot of protocols, even the iCalendar specification, which is used for like Outlook messages and this kind of thing, starts with X if it's a custom flag. I suspect there's a clause in the HTTP spec that lets you create any header called X something, but I'm just inferring. But it definitely has nothing to do with the X window environment. Other questions? All right, so what did I actually send? Well, Firebug can tell me that too. Let me go ahead and click on, whoops, let me zoom out here. Let me go ahead and click on post. So here is the spoiler for what I actually typed in. This is just Firebug's pretty printed version of what I typed, J Harvard and pass. Let's see, it sent these MIME type headers. And notice here, even though this is nicely formatting what I typed in, when we said last week that there's these two different mechanisms for submitting info from a form, there's GET, whereby things are sent in the URL, and POST, which is not, well, they're still sent in exactly the same way. Key equals value, ampersand, key equals value, and so forth. But they're sent below all of the HTTP headers. They're not sent in the top one, the GET line. They are instead sent down below. And in this way, can you even upload a photograph by Base64 encoding it, that is representing it with ASCII text somehow, and then just putting a huge number of megabytes after the headers, but in text format, structured not unlike this thing here. All right, anything else that was sent? Well, let's see what we got back. So it looks like in Firebug, this line, which was a post request to login1.php, resulted in my going to home.php. Now, how could this have possibly happened? Well, let's look at the response here. And notice this. There's one other header that's kind of juicy for discussion here. What line apparently induced my being punted to another web page altogether? Yeah, the location header. So recall that you can redirect the browser in a few different ways. This is, these days, probably the most robust, to do it at the HTTP header level and tell the browser literally with location, then colon. This, again, is Firebug's pretty printed version of the headers. Location, a URL, and then you can also send a response code, which, where is it? Do I see it here? We have to look at the raw source, shall we? What is the raw status code that the server responded with? It's not 200, which means all is well, here's some content. So 302. And there's kind of a spoiler right there. 302 means move temporarily. So recall there were two such headers you can send. And we'll start using these in the projects. 301 is permanent. That's a hint to the browser to please stop asking me for this URL, because I'm just going to keep sending you to the same place. In this case, by default, when you just send a location header, PHP, so that you don't create problems for yourself, assumes it's temporary, so that the browser, in theory, should not cache this. And if I pull up login1.php again, I will see login1.php. I won't be shuffled immediately to home.php. Now, what's the alternative? Well, some of you might have used various bulletin boards where you, let's see, what do they normally do? It's a very stupid user interface mechanism where you submit a form, whether to search for something or to log. Oh, that's what it is. What is it called? One of these V bulletin boards, one of these open source packages that's pretty omnipresent on the web. You log into your account, you then see a page saying, you have logged in successfully. You will be redirected in 5 seconds, otherwise click this link. There's no reason for that feedback mechanism. Certainly these days, right? If you log into a website and you see your account or your portfolio or your Facebook profile or whatever, it's pretty reasonable to assume my login worked. Now, this is an unfortunate, and we'll discuss this later in the term in terms of user interfaces. There's a lot of instances of things like this where you log into a website and then you're told you've been logged into that website, and now you have to wait an arbitrary number of seconds or interact with the website yet more to actually get where you're going. Can anyone think of sites that also do this? The pin page? Yeah, you literally sit there for 5 seconds like a doofus just waiting to be redirected. I've actually had conversations with them about that to understand why this is the case, and apparently it's for legacy reasons and also certain user reasons. But at least so far as the course is concerned, let's minimize the number of clicks and the number of seconds humans need to wait to interact with websites. Other sites that do something similar? What's that? banking websites? Okay. Though generally it's because they want you to like sign up for paper-free billing or something like this, which saves them money. That's another trick in the business. So they're not being green. They're being cheap. Anyhow, unrelated. So these are some of the issues we'll talk about. But more interesting to us is not necessarily just the aesthetics of these things, certainly, but really the implementation details. Because it turns out that this idea of having a link in the page that was returned saying click here if you're not redirected is actually pretty compelling, at least for people who are using browsers that might not honor this location header. Right? Back in the day, it was ideal to send the header, but then also some HTML content, even if minimal, saying click here to continue, because just in case the browser did not support this header or something went wrong and the connection got interrupted, at least then the user didn't see a blank white page. They at least saw a blue link that they could click to proceed further. Frankly, these days, most any browser your users are using should certainly understand this location header. Sending it more text is just going to introduce a tad more latency because it now needs to be downloaded, rendered, and then suddenly the user is redirected potentially. So for the most part, when you issue redirects these days, you don't bother sending any content whatsoever. But odds are these features you see on various websites that tend to use, frankly, the meta refresh tag, which is also pretty retro these days, you can do it in JavaScript, are sort of a throwback to yesteryear when this was more common by necessity. All right, so we seem to know what's going on. I type username and password into login1.php, which looked like this. The J Harvard and Crimson, which I typed in, are sent to login1.php. Apparently, they check out because then I'm redirected to home.php. So let's dive in. Let's actually see what's going on inside login1.php. And this will be the first such version that we look at. We'll improve upon this quite quickly. So notice here, you'll see different conventions in lecture, different conventions in section, and presumably you bring to the table, having programmed before, perhaps for years, your own sort of stylistic conventions. PHP supports multi-line comments in this way here. It supports one-line comments with slash slash. In general, I would go with whatever style you're most comfortable with. So far as the course is concerned, we don't have any mandates for any specific style, so long as your code is in fact neat and you're consistent with respect to yourself, and it's a reasonable stylization of code. As an aside, for many languages and for many years, there's this sort of de facto standard where code should never be longer than like 76 characters, 80 characters wide, so it fits in a standard terminal window and the like. Frankly, I think in the world of web programming, where so much of what you're writing is just more verbose than it ever was, and you're never printing out, frankly, your PHP source code most likely, or HTML source code, I would advocate that it's reasonable to allow your lines to be longer and even wrap around, because there comes a point where it's just more readable if you can read something, I think, left to right, then have a whole lot of arbitrary indentation and a whole lot of white space. But there, too, exercise your discretion. Now, this looks like a mess already because partly because of the font and partly because this doc type is particularly long. But again, be self-consistent is what the course would expect. All right, so what's going on here? Well, it looks like I actually have some PHP code up here, not because I wanted to put my comments inside of a PHP block, but because I did want to execute one function. And here's going to be some of the magic that we look at today and the weeks to come. Session start is a function that starts the notion of a session. So anyone know already, what is a session in the context of web pages? Yeah.
A visit.
So a visit. So sure, a session is a visit to a page. What else might it be? Yeah.
Is it how you implement persistence?
Yeah. So this is kind of the moniker given to the notion of persistence. HTTP, as I hinted at with this visual or this mental imagery of a spinning globe or whatever in your favorite browser. HTTP is stateless in that when you pull up a web page, it might take a few requests to get all the files, the GIFs, the pings, the HTML, and all that. But eventually, that's it. Assuming there's no AJAX in the page, that connection closes and your little icons stop moving, which is to say it's stateless. Now the server has forgotten who you are, at least with regard to that particular request. But this is surely problematic. If I'm in the process of doing some online shopping at Amazon, I have a shopping cart. Like, don't forget about me. Don't like walk away. I want to continue shopping around on your site. So somehow you have to be able to maintain persistence between client and server, even though the client might disconnect pretty often, every few seconds, every time you click from page to page and it's finished loading. So session start essentially instructs the web server to remember this user, specifically to remember this user in a way that when this same person returns, there's going to be one or more special variables that if I put, I the programmer, put anything in these variables, let's call them a hash table for now or an associative array, make sure that when this same user returns in a minute, in an hour, that you hand me back the same variable with the same contents even if, again, a few minutes have passed. So what we'll see is another super global. We saw a few last week. One was $_get. Which was a hash table, an associative array, a map, call it whatever you'd like for now, of all of the HTTP parameters that were passed via GET. There was another that we saw, which was called POST. There was REQUEST, but that one, don't use REQUEST so much because it just mixes the notion of the two. It can be useful, but in general, better to be more precise. But we're also going to introduce now something called $_session. And it's in this thing. It, too, is a map or an associative array, a hash table, just like these others. But whereas these things are populated with what the user typed in via form submission, this is kind of your own little scratch pad that you, the programmer, can put any key value pairs in there that you want. And you can trust, if you've executed session start at the top of your program, that even if this user walks away, gets a sandwich, comes back, and clicks on another page, another product on your website, you, the programmer, will be handed the same variable and the same contents as were there a few minutes ago. And so what you're really putting in the session object is more generally key value pairs. What might those key value pairs be? Well, maybe it's the product number of something I added to my shopping cart and the quantity thereof. Yeah.
So in terms of session variables, what if you're a site like Amazon and you've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of people hitting you every second for the minute? Isn't that an inefficient way of creating state in a way? I mean, aren't there more effective ways that are better for or more scalable?
So it's a good question. So with regard to high traffic sites like Amazon that have to handle huge numbers of hits per second, feels like it's pretty inefficient for the protocol itself to be stateless, first of all, and just to keep forgetting about everyone and then reconstructing all of this work, but then to have to constantly refetch the contents of this variable, whether they're using PHP or something with a similar mechanism. Short answer, yes, that is unfortunate. Slightly longer answer is this is kind of the world we built for ourselves with HTTP. It's becoming an increasing problem in the world of AJAX where you want constant refreshes of web page, but HTTP is not really about getting constant updates like SSH is or some stateful connection. Turns out PHP by default implements these things in a pretty inefficient way using disk, specifically using /temp as we'll discuss or some similar directory. But thankfully, can we leverage some of the lessons we'll discuss in our database lectures, and you can start storing this stuff in a database, at which point you're already building a dynamic website or presenting people with a dynamic website. So you're already hitting the database server based on what they type, what they click. So with the marginal cost of now getting the contents of what's in their shopping cart, it's at least on par with the work you already have
so
to
this
do.
Isn't actually
No, by contrast, it's worse. It's consuming disk that has to be read again and again. But what we'll soon see is that this little detail that we glimpsed at a moment ago, this header called PHP sesh ID, the means by which PHP and other languages remember that I am me and not some other random user is by assigning me this thing called a cookie, specifically one called PHP sesh ID by default, that itself is just a big random number that hopefully was not given to anyone else, because if it was, it means someone else can see or steal the contents of my shopping cart. So that we can switch tapes, why don't we go ahead and take a 5-minute break. All right, so we are back. So the cliffhanger that we left off with was this notion of session start and cookies and the implementation thereof as a little teaser to incentivize your sticking with us till our security lecture, certainly in the course. There is a non-trivial danger about to the fact that most every website out there these days transmits cookies as we saw here. So I'm going to re-pull up in Firebug my HTTP headers. I'm going to look at it's getting a little long here now because there's some Google stuff commingled in there. Let me look at the raw headers instead. There it is. So here we have, on the bottom, the response from the server. Here's a cookie It's called PHP sesh ID. It equals that. And then after the semicolon is some Google Analytics stuff. So we'll just ignore that. But this is a pretty big number. And it's pseudo-randomly generated, which means very low probability someone else on the server will be handed the same value. And presumably, the server could check for collisions and just give me a new one if that happens by accident. But there's a serious problem here with the fact that I am maintaining state by using this thing called a cookie that anyone, including myself, can apparently just sniff some traffic and look at. Why is this problematic? Might instinctively feel bad, but what really could someone do with this information?
Can you emulate that cookie?
Yeah, I mean, if I can see my own, and thus anyone in this room's cookie, going to at least my little cs75.net website here, then what's to stop me from exercising a bit of savvy with my own computer and maybe writing a program or using a Firefox plugin whereby I can manually specify, you know what? Visit the same website, but plug in this cookie value. Not the one I was given, but this one I just sniffed using my various free software tools to sniff all the Veer wireless traffic in this room or someone in a Starbucks cafe. This is precisely what's possible with, I'll make this up, but like 95% of the websites out there, frankly, maybe even higher. Because for the most part, websites these days, and thankfully this is starting to change slowly, but most websites these days do encrypt your traffic when you visit the login page, like Facebook does. But once you leave that login page and you're successfully authenticated, then all of your traffic goes back to HTTP. That's it, or not S. So you go from HTTPS back to HTTP after you've successfully logged in, and you can do some spot checks on all of your favorite websites. Most of them will, in fact, exercise this behavior. The login page is HTTPS, maybe the registration page is HTTPS, but then every other page on the website is just HTTP, which means if you were handed a cookie, as you probably were for any site that needs to maintain state to remember that you were logged in, something like this goes across the web in the clear. And frankly, even though I'm using a tool on my computer to sniff my computer, I can in 5 minutes have some free software on this laptop sniffing all of the wireless traffic in this building and grabbing everyone else's cookies that happens to be visiting any number of websites. Now, if I can grab people's cookies, what does this mean? Well, logically, if I am given a cookie from a website the first time I log in, and I apparently every time I revisit that website present this to the server as I am doing right here, my cookie by the way is this value. Every time I visit a page on cs75.net, this line is sent because it's a reminder to the server of the cookie it gave me the last time I visited the page, or at least the first time I actually logged in. So then what does this mean? Well, I log into Facebook.com, or pick your favorite website that uses HTTP for most things. I get a cookie. I then, on almost every subsequent page, am on HTTP only. So I am just sending this thing across the wireless internet locally, across the entire internet, even though it would be a hardwired connection. So what's the takeaway? Anyone who sniffs my traffic, grabs that cookie, and exercises, again, some savvy with their computer can then do what with my account? Immediately log in as me, right? Because all they have to do is present this token. You can think of it like a hand stamp at the carnival. Once my hand's been stamped, if someone does this, copies my stamp and presents it as their own, well, that's the only thing Facebook is probably doing to determine whether or not I am, in fact, that same person who logged in before. Now, you might push back and say, well, wait a minute. That guy probably has a different IP address. They could detect this. Yes, but frankly, a lot of us change IPs when you connect or disconnect from 3G services these days. Maybe you just walk around the office or around campus. And so within a relatively narrow window of time, your IP might change for compelling reasons. And many websites, frankly, do not cross-check cookie values against IP address, especially if there's proxy servers involved. Frankly, the IP might, in fact, change. This could create more problems than it's worth. And so most sites do not do a little sanity check like that because it could get them into trouble and start booting users off unnecessarily. So what's the takeaway? Frankly, almost any website you visit these days, if you've logged in with an account, get bounced back to HTTP, you are then vulnerable to someone hijacking your session, as they say. Session hijacking is the buzzword here. So what's the solution? I mean, frankly, this is very, very real. Yes? Yeah, I mean, that's really the solution. Thankfully, this is one of those things where this is a non-trivial problem. You could just, with a very obvious solution, if the problem is that I'm sending these cookies across the wire in clear text, well, stop sending them across the wire in clear text. We have a mechanism that encrypts things. It's called SSL. You generally just enable it by going to HTTPS, but there is a catch. You, the user, can't just say, you know what, I'm going to browse securely and change your URL. What has to happen, probably? Right, the server needs to actually support that. And a lot of web servers, Facebook's included, are probably configured to move you off of SSL as quickly as they can. Why might that be? Right, so performance, right? Because you're using encryption, cryptography, there is some cost. Maybe it's small these days, but there's some number of CPU cycles you must execute in order to do the crypto. Now, for many websites, that's not a big deal. But for a site like Facebook, for any of Google's websites, Microsoft sites, any of these big fish out there, Twitter, well, if you're getting thousands of hits, tens of thousands of hits per second, and you're spending 10 more CPU cycles, that's 10 times 10. That's a huge number more of CPU cycles that you're spending just to encrypt this traffic. What does that mean? You need 10 times as many servers now. I mean, literally, if you're increasing your load by some factor, like 10. I didn't do the math quite right there, but you need more hardware, you need more money. So there's a very real cost for large enterprises. So this was a big deal when WHO transitioned everything to SSL recently. Anyone catch this in the press? Yeah.
Gmail.
They were the biggest. And they were the ones I was thinking of when I said, thankfully, the world is starting to move in this direction. I mean, that's a non-trivial cost, even for someone like Google, because now they across the board have to incur this additional computational expense. You might recall the drama in the press about some Chinese hackers or something like that doing something. It was never quite clear exactly what happened. And it was never quite clear, at least to me, the reader, that SSL was necessarily the solution to this. But they used it as an opportunity to switch everyone to SSL. And this was actually a good thing. What other sites that you probably frequent at home or at work also are always on SSL? Banks, right? So in theory, banks tend to have a lot to lose, literally in dollars. And so even if you visit like Bank of America's fluffy homepage, which is all marketing and such, even that is by default SSL just because they encrypt the whole site. And so they're still using cookies. They're still using some of the basic building blocks we'll start leveraging, whether or not they use PHP. But this kind of stuff here, it's all being encrypted. And this actually hints at why for SSL, there's this gotcha. You need a unique IP address for SSL traffic for the most part. And that's because if you're encrypting these headers, guess what's getting encrypted along with them? Which very important field? The host name, right? So this is unfortunate. It would have been really nice, frankly, if they had just left the host name as a special case and not encrypting it too with SSL, but that's not the way the layering of these various protocols work. So if you're encrypting the host name, what this means is when the encrypted data arrives at some web server, that like a lot of commercial web hosts, hosts a lot of servers, a lot of customers, each of whom might have their own cryptography keys that they generated to use SSL, you don't know what key to use to unlock the header if it locked inside the header is the hint as to which key to use. So it's one of these catch-22s. You can assume, though, which one to use if it's coming in on a unique IP address. Then you match the key against the IP address, not against the host name. The one exception, as an aside, is if you are using subdomains in the same domain. We, for instance, for cs75.net, could buy a so-called wildcard SSL certificate that would allow us to have foo.cs75.net, bar.cs75.net, and have all those same sites live on the same IP address and just have to pay for the more expensive certificate. But the gotcha is that the upside is they could all live at the same IP address. The gotcha is that they all have to belong to us and be in the same domain. So it's great for us, but not if you want to host three different sites. You generally need three different IPs. And there, too, money, especially as IPs are increasingly scarce. A lot of ripple effects as a result of these basic mechanisms. Yeah?
Are there open source alternatives to getting an SSL certificate? Like, is there a free alternative to that?
Good question. Is there a free alternative to SSL certificates? Not really. You can encrypt things decently using JavaScript libraries. Now that browsers and computers are reasonably fast, you can do some crypto and encrypt the password, for instance, in the browser, then transmit it to the server, which is kind of a nice poor man solution. In terms of, I would say, comfort and reliability, I would personally spend the additional at least $30 a year to do it properly, do it with SSL, not have to worry about any gotchas, bugs in my own code. Plus, if you take the JavaScript approach, you can do it for sending text and forms and whatnot, but not for images, not for other media, so you can only do a subset of your traffic. I will say that even though we don't focus too much on the mechanics of buying things in the class, you can pay different amounts of money for SSL certificates. And it's perhaps worth at least highlighting this issue, lest you overpay at some point. I'm going to go somewhat arbitrarily to GoDaddy.com. I'll go to another one in just a moment for the counterpoint. Apologies. They sell domains with sexy women, usually, it seems. That's their thing. Let's see. Products. She's everywhere. Products. No, domains. Come on. Oh, there it is. SSL security. Sorry. Frankly, I don't know how they're so popular. It's a complete train wreck, their website, I think. Okay. Premium SSL. Okay. Anytime you see something called premium on the internet, don't pay for it. You probably don't need to. Frankly, the mathematics are the same, whether or not you're paying one amount or more. So just to zoom in on this, it looks like they sell what's called standard SSL. Single domain looks like is $49.99. Interesting. It used to be less expensive. It used to be like $29.99. So it looks like for $50 a year, you can buy an SSL certificate from GoDaddy. It feels kind of high. Frankly, it's a lot lower than a lot of the other folks out there. We'll pull up Network Solutions, for instance, in a moment. You can certainly pay for multiple years. And there is value in this. Silly as this may sound, I at least always forget 12 months later how to change the SSL certificate in various servers. And so I've realized the hard way, I'd rather pay three times as much up front so I don't have to figure this out again in 11 months and 30 days' time. Now, I might just be not so bright, but and you can save some money or amortize it over time, but this is such a stupid detail to have to change every year. It's probably worth pushing out the deadline if you maintain your own server. So there's some other types of certificates out there. And actually, we do splurge for a couple of my courses on the wildcard certificates so that we have the ability to maintain as many domains, as subdomains as we want, albeit under the same price tag, and it's a lot less configuration. What you get for $179.99 is the ability to have star.foo.com encrypted on your website, and it can even live at the same IP address, which is useful. Then there's these things, UCC certificates, which allow you to specify a fixed number of domains, so then it becomes a little, you know, Excel formula, you got to figure out where the right price point is for you depending on how many sites you protect. But with more and more sites comes more and more money. Unfortunately, this is generally, in my opinion, a huge scam. In the principle, the system of SSL is very compelling. Like, there is this notion that there are central authorities, like Network Solutions, like GoDaddy, that are independent third parties that are willing to make a claim that this is a legitimate business, this is a reputable website. How do you know this? Well, because we charged them some amount, we verified perhaps their mailing address and all of this, so we are the certifying authority that davidmalin.com belongs to davidmalin.com, for instance. Moreover, if David Malin is determined to be fraudulent, you know what? We can revoke his certificate because of the centralized infrastructure that is the world of SSL, so that in 6 months' time, if you, the web browser, ask us, GoDaddy or Network Solution, is davidmalin.com actually a legit website? We can tell you no. There's a catch here. What do most web browsers not do? That, right? So by default, this would just be a lot of unnecessary traffic. It would introduce latency into the connections that you have with various websites. By default, you don't contact the certification authorities, as they're called, CAs, to check, is this certificate still in fact valid? So yes, there's this mechanism of revocation, and it's, I think, conceptually and technically very compelling, but in practice, just not really used. You can do it if you're particularly uptight, and if you go through Internet Explorer or Firefox's options, you can probably find the checkbox to enable this after restart. They don't make it particularly easy to do this. Now, as an aside, browsers are getting a little better at, for instance, pre-screening websites. You have these phishing filters where they're using other checks to determine, is this a safe website or not, or have we heard some bad things about them? But in terms of SSL, you're essentially paying for the privilege for a third party like GoDaddy to stamp a certificate, a digital one though, that says you are who you claim to be. Now, just for contrast, to put this into perspective, what is this? Premium SSL. What fluff do I get for this? Includes free temporary standard SSL. So I'm going to hypothesize here, because the details are not so interesting for us right now. There are various websites where if you visit them, let me see if I can come up with one, bankofamerica.com. Okay, so this is a case of where paying even more for an SSL certificate can perhaps signal a useful mechanism to your users. There are other certificates that you can pay even more for, where the screening process is legitimately more rigorous. And what happens then is if you have paid for the premium version, your people's web browsers, depending on which browser, which version they're using, will not only say HTTPS as they normally do, they will also really draw the user's attention to the fact that this is a legit website, or at least this is a website who paid the price, which frankly a lot of phishers out there wouldn't, or people who don't even have credit cards wouldn't because they're just waging these various internet attacks. The green now means this is even more highly likely to be a legitimate website, but you pay for it. Now, out of curiosity, how many people knew that green meant better? Okay, so then what are we all paying for, right? If only one, two people in the room even knew this, so maybe this problem goes away over time, in fairness, with user education and the like, but just realize that there's a huge business behind this when really, when, so far as we care in the course, it's the technology that's interesting or useful to understand, but a lot of the finances behind this, networksolutions.com, is really a wonderfully lucrative industry for everyone other than the people making these websites. So SSL certificates, let's see what they're going to cost us. Oh, and SiteSeal, that's a favorite. Okay, so they start at $89 per year, and yet the math is the same. Then down here, look, oh, you know it's expensive if they won't even tell you the price, right? Let's see. Let's see, learn more. Oh, you get to, this is the stupidest thing. So you get to put these logos on your website to say you are safe and hacker tested. Now, how many people in this room look for this? Right? And frankly, if we're worried, I mean, the irony is, if you're looking to avoid the fraudulent websites who are trying to ensnare you and take your username and password, I mean, last time I checked, I can download this image, put it on my, so again, it's all rather silly, a lot of this stuff. But again, sort of consistent with this idea of helping, of empowering folks with knowledge of the, oh, and you know it's expensive when they show it per month, too, right? If you do the math, that's probably going to add up to even more than the $89, and sure enough, it will. A lot of this is really tailored to hooking the less technical folks who don't even understand what it is they're buying. Yeah?
I have Norton on my system, and I often get Norton verified, Norton secured, that sort of message.
Okay. Yeah, that's not bad. So this is consistent with some of the heuristics a lot of browsers are introducing where Google scans these websites and maintains a blacklist of sites they find somewhat suspicious. Semantic is similarly doing this, it sounds, where they scan these websites or they monitor email lists where people report bogus websites and such, and you have these anti-phishing filters or whatever where you get little warnings. That is more of an application layer defense, which itself is not bad, but it's very much independent of this lower level mechanism of SSL and security, which is true protection mathematically. But the catch is that even a hacker can, you know, get him or herself a SSL certificate, so you can establish a really secure connection with a bad person. I saw a hand in back. No? Okay, so let's now with that said, let's start logging into a website with HTTP. So we have now login1.php, which is where we left off the story. So let's now take a look at this file. In home.php is where we first found ourselves. Because I am checking, recall home.php says yes, I'm logged in or no, I'm not. Let's see how this is structured and then dive into login1. So similarly, must home.php call session start, because it's that page that's apparently going to check is the user logged in. But to do that, home.php needs access to this guy. And so every page that uses sessions must, in the world of PHP, call this function at the top. Now, we'll see over time and in sections that for common code like this, it feels a little silly to include it at the top of every file. We can soon start factoring this out, putting it into a config.php or some file that is essentially included automatically in all of my files. But for now, we're keeping things straightforward and just putting it where we need it. Now, this is all HTML, so pretty uninteresting. Now, there's an interesting line of dynamic output here. So let me scroll down. And it looks like this page is pretty simple. That's it. But notice now I have a branch in here, a condition. So we saw this syntax last week. Open bracket question mark means here comes some PHP. And so this is saying if inside of $_session there is a key called authenticated, and it is apparently true. So most programming languages, you have a Boolean expression in parentheses. It's going to return true or false. So this is implicitly saying, if you are authenticated, because that key has a value of 1 or anything non-zero, non-false, it's going to print out, you are logged in, line break, and then give me a link to log out. Else, what's it going to do? It's going to say you are not logged in. So this is apparently assuming that the page called login1.php's purpose in life is to get my username, get my password, check them, and then do what? Report back, but specifically how report back?
Yes or no.
So yes or no, but via what mechanism does it seem that this other page called login1.php is recording the fact that I have logged in successfully before it does that redirection back to home.php?
You said underscore session is like a hash key.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Perfect. So in login, we're kind of spoiling the surprise now. In login1.php, it must be some condition that says if the username and the password are correct, do this. Well, what is this? Apparently, if we're checking for the presence of this key and a true value in this file, home.php, it must be the case that in login1.php that I am putting that value there by storing true or one or something in this hash table that's called $_session. So a quick aside for those unfamiliar, so because it's a very simple concept even if you haven't used it before. So in most programming languages, you have ints and you have floats and you have bools and these kinds of things. But if you want to have multiple such values, you have to call it x1, x2, x3. Well, then the world came up with arrays where you can actually have something called x and you can index into multiple locations and store multiple values inside of one symbolic location called x. Well, that's great if you want to store things via numeric indices, 0, 1, 2, 3. But frankly, it'd be a lot nicer if I could just store things at arbitrary locations. If I want to store a variable essentially called authenticated and give it a value, I'd like to say open bracket quote unquote key equals some value. And so that's why you have these things called associative arrays, which essentially are called maps, are called hash tables, where you can think of it, and this is misleading because it's not organized like this usually, you can think of it as a little Excel table with keys in one column, values in another. So if I am assuming there is a key called authenticated, somewhere in memory, there's a corresponding value that apparently I'm hoping will be true. Now, as an aside, I say calling it an Excel table is kind of misleading because it's probably not laid out top to bottom, left to right like this. The beauty of a hash table in general is that you shouldn't have to search through it top to bottom to find a value. You should be able to get to it in constant time. And for that, we have very fancy data structures underneath the hood like trees and other such things. So PHP does that for us. What's nice for our purposes is you can just think of this as a locker of sorts. You can put anything in it that you want, so long as you give it a unique location. And those locations can be numbers, like in the old school arrays, or they can be actual strings, like quote unquote authenticated. So let's see how we're actually putting that key and value into this associative array.
If authenticated didn't exist in that case, would it return false?
Good question. Short answer, yes. But there's a simplification I've made that I'll come back to because depending on the system you're using, you could actually get an error from that line of code. But more on that in just a second. So login1.php, let's actually see what's going on here. Well, it turns out there's only one user supported at the moment because I don't know how to use a database yet, and I haven't used any XML or anything like that yet. And so I'm calling session start as promised, but then I'm using two constants right now. Just for demonstration purposes, I wanted to create one user, so I called I defined a constant called user, gave it a value of jharvard, and then another one called pass with the value of crimson. So yes, it is in fact the case that PHP supports the notion of constants, and there's how you might do them. So now I can say user or pass anywhere in my code, and they will map to those values. So let me scroll down a little bit. Turns out there's not much code required in login. I just need the notion of a branch, a condition, to check these values and then act accordingly. So let's see what I'm doing. Might look like a whole lot of new stuff at once, but line by line, it's all pretty straightforward. So let's see. Up here, just beyond my reach, is an if condition. So now I'm a little more pedantically using the right function for checking for the presence of a value. I'm using a function in PHP called isSet, which frankly does as the name describes. Is this variable set? If so, I care about checking its value. Now this is relevant because login1.php isn't always the destination for some form, right? I pulled up login1.php in my browser and my form was waiting for me. So this is one of the first design options we'll see in PHP. Last week we took this approach of having one file, present my form to the user, and it was called like google.html or something like that, but it could have been google.php even if there was no dynamism, and then it submitted to a different form like process.php or something like that. I think I'm mixing up the names, but the point was we had one file for the form and a second file for the backend implementation, which was kind of a farce at the time. That doesn't need to be the case. In fact, you're creating now a whole lot of work for yourself having two different files for every interaction you might want to have with the user. Moreover, there's a problem. If I fill out this form and there's some errors on it and I've submitted to this page here, well, what if I want, like most websites out there, to redisplay the form to the user? Now I have to redirect them back here, but if I'm redirecting them, now I've lost the input that they typed in unless I remember it, so it just gets messy quickly. So a nice design methodology, and you'll see this recur in lecture and in sections, is you can actually just merge things together. Just have a form, submit to the exact same file, but now that you have access to a programming language, you can just check with using code, was a form submitted? Or did the user just pull up this URL plainly, like I did a moment ago? So what this function is doing for me right now is implementing exactly that workflow. If $_post, and let me highlight this because I put it up too high, if $_post, bracket quote user, so if there is a key called user in the post superglobal, and there is a key called pass in that same superglobal, what's the logical implication here? They were both filled out and this form has been submitted. In other words, David did not just pull up this web page randomly, hit enter, and see the form appear. He actually got there, filled out the form, then hit enter, because only when the form is obviously filled out would there even be anything in post, by definition of post. So this one line of code up there is my way of saying, did the user just type in this URL or visit some bookmark or a URL in an email or something? Or did they submit a form to this page? So in this way, have we merged the notions last week of sort of source and destination into one and the same, and we can now detect which mode we're operating in, so to speak. So let's assume now I did in fact type in J. Harbin and Crimson and hit enter. What happens next? Well, now I do the equality check. Now in a real system, we'd be using a database. For here, there's just one user, but it's fine for demo purposes for now. If the user key's value equals equals, so for those, most languages have the same construct, equals equals is equality, not assignment, equals user, and pass equals pass, well, the logical implication there is even more obvious. The guy has typed in the right username and password, Mr. Harvard here, so what do I do? Well, there's that one line of code that we inferred from the checking of it earlier. Now, there is a gotcha here, it would seem. I'm in login1.php. I'm storing inside this variable, this key called authenticated, giving it a value of true. How in the world am I going to propagate this value to the other file called home.php? Especially after I redirect the user there. Yeah. Yeah, so this little wormhole of sorts, this appears magically in every .php file that I write, so long as I do what? In advance. Call session start. Because what session start's job in life is to do is to check on the server, all right, what HTTP headers were sent? Is there a cookie header? Oh, there was a cookie header. Was there a key called PHP sesh ID? If so, what was that big random value? Oh, here, it's this big random value. Let me check my file system for the file, the text file, containing the contents of this user's shopping cart or whatever from the last time he or she was here. Let me reload that into memory and then hand that to the developer in the form of this little magical box called $_session. And that story already hints at the inefficiency of it by default. By default on Linux systems, even Windows systems, when you're running PHP, these session files are generally stored in /temp or the equivalent, which is a temporary directory, which means if I am shopping on Amazon.com and they're using PHP and I've added like 20 books to my shopping cart, all of those books' data, whether it's the ISBNs they're storing or some unique key, are all being stored on disk, which means if I then load a page, walk away for a few seconds or minutes, come back, and then visit another page, and I want to see the contents of my shopping cart, the web server on Amazon has to go to that file, open it up, which, and disk is slow in principle, read it into RAM, and then repopulate this array. And so this is why, in theory, this is not the most performant mechanism, but there are alternatives even within PHP. Same, so you get same feature, but using real database, not text files. Yeah.
And that, of course, means the problem with abandoned carts. You could fill up a disk space. I assume there's got to be some cleanup somewhere that
There should be garbage collection whereby, and this is why it's often put in /temp or some other directory that's monitored so that after some number of hours or minutes or days, the directory is cleaned out for that reason. You get stale sessions otherwise. Yeah?
Did you have to predefine this field? You just came up with this field authenticated in your underscore session.
I did. Completely arbitrary.
So did you have to tell it in advance? Did you define, okay, I want to have this field in my underscore session, or just by assigning a value to it, did it happen in session?
Good question. Completely my discretion. This mechanism is so easy to use that I can just decide when I'm ready to, what I want to put there, and so long as I continue calling session start atop any PHP file, that same key's value will still be there for me. So I chose authenticated so that just conceptually, kind of the variable's name, the key's name tells the story, but I could have called it X or Y or Z. I don't have to pre-register it. It is that easy. Just plug in what you want. It's that useful. Yeah?
Are there any built-ins on the PHP session?
Good question. Short answer, no. In session, in get, in post, you don't get any contents for free. PHP feels it's done its share by just giving you these containers to begin. Wait, I should backpedal. These are by definition populated from the user's form. This one is for your benefit. You can put anything in there that you want. In fact, it'd be bad if stuff were there because you then perhaps conflate it with something you yourself put there. Yeah?
So the danger of just self-created variables is you misspell authenticated when you do your equals equals, and for some reason your program never runs. Is there some sort of lint or something that catches stuff like that?
So there is, and in fact, this is the detail I promise to not sweep under the rug. So the code I've used in this file on a lot of systems, including the cloud, will trigger what's called a notice. So I think I may have mentioned last time that PHP has different levels of error mechanisms. One is called notice. Yeah, I did tell the story because I remember saying something stupid. So it was something like notice is probably shouldn't do that, but I'm going to let you do this. I already feel stupid again. So warning is you really shouldn't do this. Here's a warning, but we're going to let you pass anyway. And error is this is just bad. Like I'm going to terminate your program right here. So this line of code, which is very readable, frankly, if the key called authenticated in session is true, go ahead and do the following. This will trigger what's called a notice in PHP speak, which means one of two things. A message will be written to the log file in /var/log or wherever on your system saying use of index called authenticated does not exist. If you're in debugging mode, I'll call it. Recall last week we turned on error reporting and I had a little function called initSet and I said display errors true. And I said, well, normally won't do this, but it's useful for development purposes. If you have that feature enabled either in code or in your php.ini global config file, the user will see this notice on the screen. It will say use of undefined index called authenticated. So this is actually useful. So there may very well be some server-side tools that you can run on your code to detect these in advance, but they're also checked at runtime. And so developing with all these error messages, notices, warnings alike on is actually pretty good because even though it might get a little annoying, it really pushes you to write rigorous code. So this would trigger a notice on most systems, including the cloud, where for pedagogical reasons we turn on notices so that you do get yelled at on the screen by default to kind of push you toward better code. Recall that there is this mechanism. I tend to find personally this to just be very distracting and unnecessarily verbose, calling isSet all over my code. So I have made sort of the conscious design choice in a lot of my projects. I am going to consciously suppress this notice that might occur because, frankly, I know what I'm doing. I know what notices might get triggered. I know I can't get an error from this line because it's so short. There's no opportunity for something super bad to happen. But a notice I'm willing to suppress. And frankly, I'd much rather look at an @ than a complete function call, which itself would have some performance hit anyway. But even that's being very nitpicky. So understand what it's doing and why it's doing it. But at the end of the day, it's really then a design decision. Frankly, if I were writing code that I had to hand to other people, I'd probably do it more pedantically and do it this way just to be extra proper, but not for my own code. Other questions? All right, so can we do better than this? So let's take a look at login 2, which is a slight variant of this. So now I've added a nice little feature. Oh, and actually, it's not much, doesn't do us much good to see 2 before scrolling down to the very bottom of 1. So there's not much PHP code here. This whole top of the block is in PHP mode, so to speak. And this is important to note. When you do implement this methodology of merging the notion of sort of the form and then the processing back end for it into one file, generally it's good practice or a nice approach to put the PHP code at the top of the file, at least to the extent possible, because then notice what I've done. If the user does log in correctly, notice what header I issue. To redirect a user, you can use this function called header. I then pass in this URL. I'm going to wave my hands at these lines of code. They're adopted from the PHP manual. This is the right way to redirect the user to figure out what the full URL is. If you only know the file you want to send them to, you technically should send a whole URL. So if you want to read, and we'll post this code online, that URL, you'll see the discussion of it. But this is important. Exit. Because this means I'm not going to even, if I've logged in successfully, I'm not going to get to any of this file here, which is good because this contains the login form, which is now a moot feature. I want to be redirected to home.php. So it's a pretty nice workflow, I think, especially if you want to merge what could be 2 pieces of a puzzle into just 1. Yeah?
What happens if you fail
to what? What happens if I fail to what?
The initial
check. If I fail the initial check, so this one up here? So if I fail the initial check, or even the innermost if condition, I'm going to keep following through. And so what's going to happen is literally all the stuff to follow is going to be spit out to the browser. But this is actually a good thing, because recall that if I get the password wrong, I want to see the same form again. In fact, I want to see one additional detail. And this is the detail I wanted to reveal. So I wanted to see that invalid login or whatever error message that I spit out before. How did I do that? Well, notice I chose this approach. And there's different ways I could have done this. But one such approach was to leverage the fact that post is only going to contain something if what's the case? If I actually supplied a value. Now, I don't care how many things are in there. If there's one or more, the only way that can happen is if the user actually posted, so I can leverage this. PHP has a function called count. So if the number of things in post, the number of keys, which is what the count function counts, is greater than 0, the implication is form was submitted. Now again, logically, if a form was submitted and I'm at this point in the story, what's the implication logically? Something was wrong, right? The only way, because of how I've constructed this fairly short program, that I can get to this point is if the user did try to log in but failed because username's wrong, password's wrong, both were blank, something like that. So what then do I want to do? Well, I can use the echo function. Again, many ways to do this. There's a print function. There's a printf function. I'm keeping it simple for now. I'm going to echo invalid login. Now, there's no notion of color here. I didn't format this very nicely. But it's just a conditional check because I wanted a minor feedback mechanism, at least for demonstration purposes. The rest of this file is all static except for one line. Notice that I can also do this little trick for the action attribute of this form. You know, it's arguably a nice practice to not hard code into your file the name of the file, lest you do what?
Change
the file name. Because if you change the file name from login1.php to just login.php, which I might when I'm ready to ship this code, now I have to remember to change the innermost contents. So it turns out there's another super global, which will be pre-populated for us with a whole bunch of juicy information. Among them, the server's IP, the server's host name, whether or not SSL is on or off, and also the name of the current file, which can be useful if you want to refer to yourself programmatically. But we'll see over time some other tricks in there. But that's it. This login form, though, lacks a very useful feature. What do most websites do when you mess up your username or password? What's that? Okay, so they offer you a chance to get a hint like password reminder or such, or suppose you just made a typo and you don't really need to go through that process? Yeah, at least the username's probably pre-populated, so I don't have to retype in mailin@whatever.com. I can just use the same username. This, of course, assumes that I got my username right and my password wrong, which probably is the case more often than not, so it's a reasonable assumption. Pre-populating the password field probably wouldn't make much sense because I didn't even see it. It's the little bullet symbols most likely, so how could I correct it? And plus, that wouldn't necessarily be secure because then the browser might cache what I did type in. A lot of reasons not to do that. But let's at least pre-populate the username field. So version 2, which we'll put online, login2.php. I'm going to skim through it because it's identical. All the way up until 1 point. What's the one difference if you can do a visual diff? Yeah, so it's as simple as this. And this too is flawed in some way. I'm keeping it simple for the moment. Notice that I'm outputting to the value attribute, which is an HTML thing for an input. I'm outputting whatever the user typed in. Now, I say there's two flaws here, because again, I was trying to keep the code simple, but one, bad things could happen if what's the case here? Right, if there wasn't a user key there at all, it just wasn't submitted for some weird reason, it should be, but you could concoct scenarios where it's not, but that's not a huge issue. But using isSet or using a condition in there probably would have been a little safer, but there's actually arguably a security problem here, or one that's suggestive of one. What am I doing here? Yeah? What's that? So I give away whether the user exists? Not so much. I'm just telling them what they told me, right? So I'm not checking this per se. I'm just typing what they typed in. And did you have a thought? Yeah, so it's not quite that issue, but it hints at that. I seem to very naively be spitting out to my web page exactly what the user typed in. So you know what? If they typed in a whole bunch of HTML, that could completely mess up the rendering of my site. They could type in some JavaScript code, and then that would then get rendered on the site and executed. Now, I'll push back and say it's not quite as scary as what we'll call SQL injection tax, which we'll discuss in a couple of weeks, because really the only person they're going to screw over here is themselves. If they're injecting bogus HTML or bogus JavaScript into the web page, they themselves are then going to view. So it's not so much an issue, but it's suggestive of sloppy programming on my part. And so what you'll really want to do is get into the habit for something like this, if only so that the user doesn't accidentally mess up your web page by outputting, for instance, an angle bracket, which might confuse the whole web page, and then they think it's your fault. And frankly, it is. If the page doesn't render correctly, they walk away, go to another company, buy something from someone else, and now you're out the sale because of one stupid omission. So in general in PHP, the function here is called HTML special chars. Unfortunately, PHP, like XML, is not very succinct. But what this will do is convert any potentially dangerous characters like open brackets or ampersand or any of these special characters in the world of HTML to their HTML entity equivalents, so the user will see literally what they typed, not what the browser interprets that character to be. So more on this in our discussions of security. Why don't we call it a night? Section will start in a few minutes' time across the hall, and I'll stick around here or in the lobby for one-on-one questions.